It's day 18 of the war in Ukraine. The images of devastation and heartbreak are reminiscent of World War II. I'm Vanessa Levenstein from Fine Music Radio, and just under 2 weeks ago, I first spoke to American-Ukrainian conductor Theodore Kutcher about his experience leaving Ukraine. And because it's all happening so quickly, it's time to touch base again. Ted, thank you for joining us. Are you still in Finland?
I am still in Helsinki, but I will be traveling to New York tomorrow because that's how my life was planned already many, many months ago. And I'm simply staying with the plan. So I will be flying to New York tomorrow, and I will be in the United States for the next several weeks where I have professional obligations.
You mentioned since leaving, you're trying to raise funds for the military in Ukraine.
Absolutely. You know, I hope it was made clear, or I hope it was understood, that many people had already begun the exodus, begun leaving Ukraine long before I even contemplated it. I mean, it was very clear to those of us who were in the western portion of the country, in Lviv, what has been happening in the eastern half. But in the earliest stages, close to the eastern border. And we must never forget that this war is not something which simply landed out of nowhere several weeks ago, or that it was simply an inspiration or a figment of somebody's imagination to begin this. This war began in 2014. You may remember the Maidan Revolution, which took place. You may remember that Putin took complete occupation of Crimea, which has been Ukrainian territory for quite a long time. And this action was absolutely unopposed by the West. And simply to continue with that, there has been a war which has been going on. There have been Ukrainians and Russians who have been shooting each other and dying every single day since 2014. This was not reported regularly, although for those of us who had regular contact with Ukraine, this was a major topic of conversation. This conflict has been going on since 2014, where people have been dying, and there have been tens of thousands of Russian troops on the eastern border. And it was clear while this was going on that the ultimate plan, at least as I heard discussed, was that Putin, Russia, cannot be regarded as a superpower unless they have the supreme naval forces. And to have naval forces, you have to have access to a major body of water. And in the context of world geography, that major body of water happens to be the Black Sea. But yet, without Ukraine, there is really no direct communication by land to that. So there was always a feeling that this war that has been going on since 2014 existed largely for the sake of ultimately taking over the land, which would give a direct land access of Russia to the Black Sea. Jump forward to the year 2022, almost 3 weeks ago. I wasn't as aware as people on the inside, but I think I mentioned in our last conversation when I discussed this matter with senior people from the American embassy here in Ukraine. And this conversation was, my goodness, was already 3 weeks ago today. They had left Kiev, as had a number of other embassies. They left Kiev because there was uncertainty. And the feeling was everything will remain stable in Western Ukraine, which is where they had relocated. Well, lo and behold, after that conversation on the Sunday evening, on the Monday morning, they received a message about 6 a.m., told to evacuate immediately because it had officially begun. And the bombings, the missiles had begun. And of course, this was already after the entire northern border of Ukraine, not to mention the entire border of Belarus with Ukraine, was completely lined up with forces, and it was clear that they were not standing there for a photo opportunity, that this was going to eventuate into something. So it finally began, and to be honest with you, when it began, I sat at home. The sirens were waking us up at 4 o'clock in the morning, at 4:30 in the morning, not because Lviv was being hit by the missiles or bombed at that moment, but there were missiles flying over. You know, things were being shot from the border, 400 miles to the north. So there was the feeling that things were going in a very unhealthy direction. And the damage that was being done by the day, it was expanding. It was becoming wider and wider. And then I received a call, again, from contacts at the American Embassy. And this was the second time I had heard that day that this is a war against Ukraine. This is a war against the United States and NATO. And if it should happen that Russia takes over Ukraine in a matter of a few days, and of course that wasn't going to happen because already this was the fourth or fifth day, and they had barely penetrated the east, despite the massive destruction and loss of lives that had taken place, it was made clear to me twice that day that if they should quickly take over the country, of course, the borders will be closed. It may not be possible to get out. And you can be sure that any Americans, especially those with a profile, will not be in a very good position. And when I heard that, I thought enough is enough. I don't think there's going to be any rehearsal tomorrow. I don't think there's going to be a concert this week, not with what's going on. And we discussed how I left the country and the mass exodus that I saw. We discussed about that. What's interesting and what we see is they don't necessarily target the cities when they are coming in for the kill, but they tend to target the outskirts and what is around, and then I suspect to try to choke off. And we see that with Kharkiv, Kharkov. We see that with Mariupol, which we hear about every day. And
the Pope spoke about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
But with ceasefire agreements, people are not even allowed to get out, but they're killed trying to escape with their suitcases. Simply to go back to your original question,
yeah.
This is all, it's moving west, it's moving north, it's moving south. You know, he's trying to close off the entire sea access.
Ted, and, are you using yes. music? Are you using your contacts in the music world to raise money and to raise awareness?
Look, my life has largely been musically related. I mean, people I deal with who are business people, who are sponsors of the orchestras that I've been the conductor of, managements which have arranged tours. You know, one person who approached me was Klaus Heyman, the president of the Naxos record label. He contacted me several days ago and he said, "Mr. Kuchar, I would like to do everything within my resources to be supportive of Ukraine. First of all, from myself and my wife, I would like to make a contribution," which was very significant. And then on behalf of Naxos, he wanted also to make a significant contribution. But then you may, in fact, have seen he very quickly had Naxos produce a compilation, a box set of all of the Ukrainian discs that Naxos has created over the past several decades, which meant the complete symphonies of Yatushinsky, which is how my relationship with Naxos and the National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine had started. Symphonies of Yevhen Stankovich, who I regard as the most important living composer in Ukraine. Miroslav Skorik, the other major composer who only passed away during the past year, his complete violin concertos. So in actual fact, there were nearly 10 recordings of Ukrainian music which Naxos had produced. And he said to me, in addition to what Klaus Heyman has promised to contribute out of his own pocket on behalf of Naxos, that $2 from every Ukrainian recording which Naxos has made, plus this compilation, he will use strictly for Ukrainian purposes. Yes. And he asked what the needs were. And as many of the people from Ukraine have been telling me, in fact, I speak with the director of my orchestra in Lviv every day, and he's very well connected, not only in the music industry, but...
Can I interrupt and ask you where he is right now?
He's in Lviv. I think he said he went out of the city. He went to a country house. They have many people there have...
summer houses.
Summer houses. And told him about the offers of Mr. Heyman and other people in the United States who had been speaking with me. Mr. Heyman is based in Hong Kong. But people in the United States and Australia, in fact. And I saw that several of the orchestras with which I've had very close relationships with for several decades in Australia, they were initiating and promoting campaigns to contribute to the Red Cross, which I think internationally was regarded as the safest way to get funds and assistance into Ukraine. But what's interesting is when I spoke with my colleagues, I told you the director of the orchestra, I asked him if he can speak directly with the governor of Western Ukraine. I told Misha, my friend, I said, Misha, can you please speak with Mr. Kozitsky, the governor, the gubernator, that here is this possibility. And in fact, Andriy Mokritsky, who has engineered every single recording for Naxos that I've made going back to, you know, the mid-90s, and we continue to work together. In fact, he engineered the record that I sent you the review about just a few hours ago.
Remarkable.
Which, you know, 10, 10, 10, you can't do much better.
De Hartman.
Yes, De Hartman. This is going to be the biggest, the BBC described it as the most important recording venture of the new decade.
And you had just finished recording it, is that correct?
We undertook the first three recordings of the Thomas De Hartman project in September of 2021. So, God, it seems like yesterday, but it was about 6 months ago. And the first recording was released just last week. And you saw the review that David Hurwitz wrote on classicstoday.com, which I regard as the most influential and most respected classical music recording site in the United States of America, and one of the most respected and watched in the world. The reaction, not just to the music, which remains unknown, but also, maybe for me most importantly, that what is largely an unknown orchestra in the outer world made such a strong and positive impression to a person who was used to writing reviews about the Berlin Philharmonic and the Cleveland Orchestra and the Cape Town Philharmonic. So I'm very happy.
I'm so glad you're putting Cape Town Philharmonic. Yeah. Just to get back to you, so where's the money going to go? Have you made sure that it's going to go to the best?
Well, let me finish what I was saying. So interesting that Andriy Mokritsky, the engineer, and the gubernator, the governor, Mr. Kozitsky, both said very similar things. We don't need food because we've got plenty of wheat. We've got plenty of bread. And we can find that. We don't need water because we've got plenty of water in the ground, some the cleanest and the best water in the world. We wouldn't be here right now if our military was not successful in fighting off what is going on. And
sorry, and just clarify, and this is in Lviv.
Yes. But of course, we were speaking about the country. We're speaking about Ukraine.
Okay. But because obviously, Mariupol, they had cut it off and there was no food. And
yes, and having access to that food is of course, what is difficult. Because the Russians have blocked it off, the access. So, you know, even if the Red Cross brought in trucks and trucks and trucks of bread or whatever, it doesn't mean that the Russian occupied areas would allow anything to get in. That's the area. That which is occupied is blocked, which goes back to what I said in the very beginning of the interview, that had I stayed there and everything, had I been in a region which had been already blocked off, I wouldn't have been able to leave.
No.
During those supposed ceasefires, when people began to leave, but then the Russians decided once again, we're not going to honor that. They started shooting.
The human corridors.
You saw what happened. So what the Polish people have done for the Ukrainians fleeing, there's no word for it.
No.
You know, they've opened their doors, as have the countries of the European Union. Now even the UK is now giving, you know, Ukrainians the possibility of staying a fixed amount of time.
We're not going to talk about South Africa's reaction.
Any assistance that is given, they want to be sure that it's being spent and sent in the correct way. It's a terrible refugee problem right now. These people have no homes. They don't have money with which to survive. So this is not just a Ukrainian problem. This is a problem on a much larger scale. And all I can say is that even if it stopped right now, the destruction which is present, nobody could return back to what they've left. And Ukraine was certainly not a wealthy country to begin with. So whoever is going to attempt to bring this country not just back to its feet, but to a livable place, there's going to be an incredible amount of work and cost. First, to clean out the damage, but then to begin to rebuild it. So the damage that has been done is terrible imagination couldn't even begin. And as I saw myself, and I didn't see anything close to what's going on right now, when you see it in real life and you see it on such a large scale, there's no television footage that can begin to even come close into bringing the true horror of this.
So Ted, so the money that Naxos and people are contributing must go to the military to help them protect.
The feeling now is that the military is the number one recipient. But at the same time, the governor said so many Western countries have been so extremely generous in terms of what they've been providing. You know, America's providing not physical labor, but they're providing weaponry. They're providing that which is necessary to fight a war. And the European countries, you know, Poland is helping in many different ways. The UK has been helpful. All the Western countries, all the European Union countries, Australia has helped in its own way.
I'm grateful that you're going to the States, because again, we're watching the news. It is shattering. Mm-hmm. It is frightening, but it is so distant in a way. And when we know somebody who knows somebody, and that somebody's you, that all of a sudden becomes real and tangible. It's those personal stories, it's those touch points that I think we as humans need to make sense of something that just doesn't make sense, or to connect with something that's impossible to connect with.
We often hear the question, who needs culture, classical music, who needs it? Oh, that belonged to cultures that and generations which have left us. But, you know, something even as simple as this review that came out this morning, where the reviewer, David Hurwitz, first of all, compares the music to the best of the 20th century.
And this is the Lviv?
The Lviv National Philharmonic Orchestra of Ukraine. I'm first speaking about Thomas de Hartmann, who was born in Ukraine. He was born of German ancestry, but born in Ukraine. First of all, it puts his roots, his musical education in an international perspective. Something like the review that we just spoke about, it puts the level of the professionalism of the people. It puts the level, obviously, of the education which those professionals must have received, and ultimately the product which they are able to produce, which is on the recording, in a very high international context. This is not just some former Soviet Republic in which the music, in which the existence is on some distance. No. What exists here, if it's allowed to thrive and allowed to develop, is on a very high European international level. And I'm very happy that the work of not just the Lviv Orchestra, the National Symphony of Ukraine, with which I was associated and am associated with, I mean, this is like my family, since 1993. And of course, orchestras in Odessa, Kharkiv, Dnipropetrovsk, Dnipro. These are all very, very good orchestras. And that's after having spent, you know, the many visits to Cape Town, having been the music director of a number of excellent orchestras in America and Australia, Venezuela. Ukraine is a country that has been damned and had a curse put on it because of geographical reasons. You know, it sits right in the middle of what we know on its right side, and we know what exists on the left. And the most oppressive, terroristic regimes which have existed throughout the centuries, unfortunately, have used some form of Ukrainian territory as that meeting point where the two opposing forces are in an undeniable position of where they're being forced to meet. And this has been the black cloud and the hex that this country has had upon itself. And you know what? These approximately 30 years that the country has had as a democracy since the demise of the Soviet Union have probably been the most productive and positive 30 years that the country has had. Because people have been able to have an exposure to the West. You know, of course, the internet has helped very much. But with free travel, with people being able to go out, but also so many people being able to come in, it's allowed for people's way of thinking, people's own professionalism, how they approach life, to become much more expanded than when it was a closed country. And unfortunately, that was not seen in a positive context by certain people, and the price is being paid at this very moment.
It reminds me of Lord of the Rings. It's so good and evil. There is just evil invading good, and it's so clear to the world, and it's just so deeply tragic. If by some miracle you will return to your orchestra one day, to your beautiful musicians, to the stage, and you had to choose one piece of music. Piece of music would say, we're back.
You know what? I've learned one thing in my old age. I've quite often answered questions within seconds of when they've been asked. And every time I hear the answer, I look in the mirror and think, how could I have said something so stupid? Now, I will not give answers that I know I will regret. I could name 100 pieces, and don't ask me to name even several of them. That's not the point. But I'll tell you even right now, let's take your question and go to a variation of that question. Mm-hmm. just a few hours ago, we were discussing repertoire that I should be conducting when I have a few weeks of work in Australia in June. And the first week, we had been planning that the Tchaikovsky Fifth Symphony would be the main work in the second half of the program. And in fact, oh, Ted, you haven't been here for years. You know, let's do it without a soloist. I think you should have the whole concert for yourself. So I asked, I said, well, what hasn't been done? What's been done? So we talked about, oh, maybe we should do selections from Prokofiev's Cinderella or Romeo and Juliet, and then possibly a Ukrainian work to begin. So, you know, on paper, it's a well-rounded program. And you have something from the 20th century, something from the end of the 19th century. And of course, I would love to have said Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, but I think after COVID, where everybody was forced to play with orchestras not exceeding, you know, 30 or 35, where every musician was sitting on a stand with masks, I think people are so happy finally not to be playing a small orchestra repertoire that I was very careful not to go in that direction. But then the question was asked to me, Ted, when we spoke last time, you were telling us that there are many orchestras that are eliminating Russian repertoire from their programs. And that question also has certain delicate connotations attached to it. First of all, what is Russian music when Tchaikovsky's parents were both born in Ukraine? When Tchaikovsky is not his real last name, but his family's last name was Chaika, and they were from Ukraine. Stravinsky, Russian composer. Yeah, but Stravinsky's family has all of its roots in what is Ukraine. Prokofiev was born in what is Ukraine. Was he Russian? Yes, he was Russian, but he was born in Ukraine. So
when we were choosing the piece for the first podcast, I sat with Rodney Trudgeon and he gave me a lovely double CD set of your work with your orchestra, and we chose Shostakovich, which was quite interesting. And we started discussing, and I said somebody, I think in Cardiff, Wales, an orchestra had, they said they're not playing Tchaikovsky. And I thought, we do not burn books and say no to music. And what Rodney said is, during World War II, did we stop playing Beethoven? So I'm very pleased you brought that up.
Well, what I want to say to you is that there is not a Ukrainian philosophy on this matter. There is not a Ukrainian view on this matter. Because when I was speaking, for example, with the administration in the opera in Lviv, and I was discussing, when did you last do Yevgeny Onegin, Eugene Onegin of Tchaikovsky, or when have you last done the Rimsky-Korsakov this or Rimsky-Korsakov that? And they said, Theodore, you know, with what's going on now, and this was now 2 years ago, when the war on the eastern border, the one that's been going on since 2014, that was still in everybody's mind as a conflict with Russia. So this is what's happening right now is just an extension of that. But I'm talking about a philosophy to music right now.
Yeah.
The administration in Lviv said, we don't and we will not do Tchaikovsky operas. We will not do Rimsky-Korsakov operas because of the war, and we will not have Russian repertoire. And that's when I told them, you know, what I find very much a shame is that the music of Dvorak has been so neglected in these former Russian cultures. I think that many Soviet cultural organizations, they didn't necessarily look at the source of music, of literature. Was it Russian? Was it Ukrainian? No, it's all from the empire. You know, it was like a big pot of borscht. Nobody really separated what were the beets, what were the potatoes, what was the cabbage. It was all part of one whole. And that was one of the great enemies and obstacles of the successful Soviet Union. Nationalism. You take away the identity of each little piece because it now belongs to a very big whole. But what am I saying here? I always heard the word Ukraine and Ukrainians. I always heard the word Poland and Polish people, the Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia, and Czech and Slovak people talk about themselves as being part of a Slavic culture. We are Slavic. Russians rarely talk about we are Slavic, we are Russians. But why am I saying this? My beloved composer. Okay, we're getting somewhere now with your question. Mm-hmm. If I had to take the output of one composer in which I was being thrown in prison or left on an island until death, it would probably be the music of Dvorak. I feel closest to what is known as Czech music, but not only because it's Czech music. I grew up with parents who insisted on a very Ukrainian environment in the house. We had to speak the language. We were taken to everything having to do with Ukrainian culture, whether it was dancing, whether it was music, whether it was literature. But then I was subjected to having to study the violin. And as an 11-year-old, as a 12-year-old, I always was amazed by the fact that my life was divided into these two very separate directions. That was one being of a Ukrainian background and having it made clear to me that I must preserve that Ukrainian
in
background.
The States. And this is growing up in the States.
Yes. But from the other side, the importance of classical music, the violin, and everything associated with studying music, you know, orchestra, etc. And that they were so different. And how could I have such sadistic parents who forced me to be so exposed to both of them? And the only time I ever felt a connection between these two very distinct worlds was when I began listening to and performing, this is a teenager, the music of Dvorak. Everything that I associate with Ukrainian folk music, Ukrainian culture, I felt much more in the music of Dvorak than any other classical composer. It was interesting that when I came to Kiev for the first time and began the relationship with the National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine, I understood very quickly, but was amazed that, especially when we went on tours, because you had to present repertoire which the outer world associates with your culture. But I began to understand that in Kiev, they felt that, oh, Tchaikovsky, oh, Korsakov, and then of course later, Shostakovich, this is our soul, this is our music, this is ours. And you know, my goal when I started working there was to try to program repertoire that was new for them, that was not done. When I was planning my first return to Kiev, this was before I was the principal conductor, the orchestra was forced to play in this old Soviet-style lecture theater because the Philharmonia, the concert hall, which had been their home for the last 100 years, it was under renovation. When they built the subway, it was going underneath the Philharmonia, and apparently the foundations had been severely damaged by the subway, and they closed it down because there were architectural instabilities. And I thought, how can an orchestra of this level be playing in this terrible lecture theater, which seated probably 600 or 700, but it had no acoustic. It made playing a pain. And I started asking people, I said, look, what are you doing to try to make your lives better? Fine. You're not the first ones where the concert hall has been closed due to renovation or reconstruction. Okay, plenty of orchestras have to look for other venues. But what have you done to look for something else or to improve your situation?
Oh, well, conservatory, they also have a concert hall, but acoustic is also very bad. And they don't let us have the hall because they have their own things there. So we maybe can play one or two concerts here or there. I said, okay, fine. I said, tell me, are there any cathedrals or large churches? Well, Teodor Teodorovich, maybe you don't understand that in the Orthodox Church, instrumental music is not allowed. I said, I know that. I grew up listening to these great theories. I said, but that's not the only religion. I said, don't you have any cathedrals? I said, look, some of the greatest venues in Central and Western Europe are cathedrals, you know, churches.
And these are legendary musical venues going back to the time of the Baroque. You know, our profession literally has its roots in the church.
Well, yeah, there's one Roman Catholic cathedral here. It's the Polish Cathedral. Is that really? Yeah. But nobody, there's nobody would ever come to the concert. Ah, really.
I said, how many does it seat? Ah, probably 600 or 700. I said, exactly like where you've been playing here in this non-acoustical place. I kept all of this. And then I started thinking, who, and this is, you know, going back to the early 90s. I was living in Australia at the time. And, you know, who were the composers that made the biggest sensations with the great orchestras, especially, you know, in America? That was my point of reference because that's where I grew up. The 70s and the early 80s, especially when digital technology came about and every recording company, every record label was looking for a way to outdo their competition. You know who the household names of the orchestral industry were? It was Gustav Mahler and Bruckner even began to become a very famous name. And I remember I asked in Kiev, I said, tell me, what Mahler have you done here? And you know, the person who gave me the first answer, I can't say that this ever became a friend, but I remember everything that people tell me. They said, no, we didn't play Mahler here because he was Jewish. So wait. Well, yeah, we don't play music by Jewish composers. I said, wait, hang on a sec. What are you talking about? You don't play in churches. You don't play Mahler. No. Fine. I didn't care to carry on the conversation because a conversation with such an intellect wasn't going to go very, very far. And and then I asked, tell me, what kind of choral works do you do here? I said, you know, if you want to build an audience, traditionally, it's works from the orchestral literature involving a chorus that tend to bring the largest audiences. And why? Because choruses tend not to be professional. Choruses, when they collaborate with a local symphony, it's the highlight of their year. Every chorister brings at least their family members and a lover or a partner. So that's already 5 people for every one of the 100 plus people in the chorus. No. We maybe play Verdi Requiem when we go on tour to Poland or blah, blah, blah. But no, in Kiev, no. I mean, yeah, choral music, that's not that. We're a symphony orchestra. I said, yes, but so the greatest facts, fun facts, they should put this on a candy bar. The greatest fun facts I had from that first intellectual conversation I had in Kiev in 1993 was we don't play in places of worship. We don't play music by Jewish composers. And we don't do anything with the chorus because we're a symphony orchestra. Maestro, I came to them for 1 week. That first week turned out so wonderful that they canceled the conductor for the second week. And I stayed for 3 weeks. But at the end of the 3 weeks, they wanted to establish a relationship. And I said, you know, you can't pay me anything. You can't cover my travel. So the only payment I'm going to get out of a relationship with you people is musical satisfaction.
That's beautiful.
That's going to be my payment for returning back here. And I said, I want to break all of your rules because it'll make me feel like a troublemaker. And even if you never ask me back again, I'll feel I did something good. We're going to play in a cathedral. We're going to do something by a Jewish composer. And we're going to bring in a chorus.
I'm going to start applauding.
So,
and you did it.
I asked somebody who became like my right hand, a very close friend. I asked him then, I said, where's this Polish Roman Catholic cathedral? Oh, it's just across the street from where we live. I'll take you there. And I looked inside and I said, Mamma mia, this is like going back into the 19th century. Look what intricate work. Look at the pews. And I thought, do you ever play here? No, they have organ repertoire here. Oh, sometimes they play Baroque music here. I said, but what about the orchestra? I said, look, I said, you can fit an orchestra here. But they said, no. Nobody would ever come here. Nobody's going to come listen to symphonic repertoire in a church. Are you kidding? I said, no. My question is, are you kidding? This is what we're going to do. So I decided, okay, going to have the Ukrainian premiere of the Mahler Second Symphony. You're going to bring in a chorus. We're going to do it here. And we're going to expand your repertoire a little bit.
And you did.
I was told, oh, you want to come back in February. You said your only free week is in February. I said, yeah. Oh, there's no heating here. It's going to be cold. I said, it's going to be cold for all of us. Oh, but look, there's no room for the orchestra and the chorus. I said, you know, have you ever been to the Amsterdam Concertgebouw? When it's empty, you look at that stage and you can't imagine how a Mozart-sized orchestra plays here. But you know what? They find a way. And no orchestra has a longer standing tradition playing Mahler and Bruckner than the Amsterdam Concertgebouw Orchestra. I said, you know what? We'll find a way to make it happen. To make a long story short, they convinced me it was going to be a catastrophe. Nobody would come. People were sitting on the floors. Every pew was full. People were sitting. There were television stations there with cameras. And now that orchestra plays Mahler pretty regularly. Now they've done so many major choral works with orchestra that go beyond just the Beethoven Ninth Symphony or Verdi Requiem. So, I mean, it's been a long process. It was an education for me because I was put into situations I never would have had anywhere else. But I think we very much expanded, you know, the repertoire.
And their mindset and the way they felt and the way they perhaps experienced life after that.
So it was a great education for all of us. You know, many of us, we all learned different things, but if you put it under one umbrella, it was all a wonderful education. And, you know, if we go a little bit further during the 90s, the post-Soviet period, it was very difficult financially. I mean, the government was in a terrible state. Government employees, which means orchestral musicians, opera, teachers in schools, in universities, doctors working in government hospitals. The country was so poor that people went without salaries for 6, 8. I think there was one period up to 10 months. And I didn't understand the severity of it until even in the past year, people told me, you know, my son, who is now a surgeon, you may not remember, but Teodor Teodorovich, I just want to tell you that those recordings, those tours that we had with you, you know, we weren't getting our salaries. We would have starved. So-and-so, my son would never become the surgeon or, you know, the violinist. We couldn't have bought him an instrument if we didn't have those recordings, if we didn't have those opportunities to earn a bit. So, like I said, it's been a part of my life. I'm embarrassed to say almost 30 years, not quite, 25 plus years. But it's been a phenomenal education for every one of us. And not just a musical education, but it's been a great education in life.
Ted, are those musicians now fighting, a lot of them? Are they now soldiers?
You know, soldier is a very dangerous word because the fight the country is having right now doesn't just mean you're a soldier. You know, there are trains which go from Lviv back to Kiev, from Kiev back to Kharkiv. And there are goods which are coming in from the West, like we discussed, whether it's food, whether it's medical supplies, whether it's military supplies. Who's unloading those trains? Who's unloading the trains and getting them into the buildings? Who's transporting them to people? I think
effort would be a better term of phrase.
I believe that every single person who is alive at this moment in Ukraine is being a very courageous soldier. Mm. But soldier in this context doesn't only mean holding a gun and shooting. Sure. Everybody is playing a very important role in continuing the human existence, in other words, life. Mm. And it could not have lasted to this moment, and it will not continue to last if every person does not take an active role. And that's why in many ways I feel very guilty for not being there. I mean, but I was never sitting there 52 weeks of the year. I would spend several weeks and I had my commitments elsewhere. So that's just a fact of life. That's how it is. I would have been here, war or no war. But we're speaking about the situation.
You concede that there's a room in the country and out the country to fight this.
Absolutely. And I'm happy that if I was not out of the country, I would not be able to communicate with all of these various people who are making significant contributions. I would not be in a position, you know, just so you know, the Lviv National Philharmonic Orchestra of Ukraine, which we made this recording, which I was to be conducting this past week, we have a tour to the United States in January, February of 2023. And naturally, the management wants to get as many concerts as possible. And even in the context of that tour. Well, do you know what several correspondences resulted into? On Friday, I received confirmation that Carnegie Hall has engaged the Lviv National Philharmonic Orchestra of Ukraine for February 15th, 2023. It's the first time a Ukrainian collective has gotten into Carnegie Hall. I don't want to say New York City, but I will say Carnegie Hall. Do you know what a big deal that is? Especially because most great orchestras, they can't even afford that. Carnegie Hall is not only by invitation, it's usually a financial commitment on behalf of the orchestra that is to be performing there. And I'm very happy to know that just this communication, and by being here, there are a number of positive things which have happened for Ukraine also. We have to now hope that everything will be in a condition that the orchestra will play. I mean, we had many recordings planned for this year.
That's going to create publicity and that's going to create awareness and that is going to create funds. Everyone has a role and your role is doing what you're doing right now. Take care. You've got your phone calls to make. You've got to pack up.
Thank you. And I'm looking forward to seeing everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Keep in contact. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a Fine Music Radio podcast, The Sound of War, with world-class conductor Theodore Kutcher.
Every